keys. There's new ones that can go to sleep. There are things like trackers that can be a good deterrent. But there's also, it's really arming yourself with knowledge. Know what system you've got, if there's any vulnerabilities, and then your dealer and the car makers. And there's plenty of information online as to how to protect yourself and take measures.
Well, that was Richard Billyeal, the Chief Research and Operations Officer at Thatcham Research. We are about to have that great point in the day, which is that Jane and Fee are about to broadcast. Very exciting it is.
Well, did you just see us in a pre-production meeting there, mouthing each other?
I was very impressed at the research that was going on. Do you keep your keyless cars safe from being stolen?
No, I'm just trying to work out. I can't even remember whether I've got a keyless car. No, I've got a car with a key. But I have to have the keys in the car, but I don't have to put the key in the lock anymore. All that's gone, isn't it?
The one I hate are the hotel electronic keys, because you get all your way to your room and then they never, ever work.
No, they go trudging back to reception with your tail between your legs.
Welcome to the modern world, everybody.
Okay, well, I look forward to hearing you. This was Daniel Finkelstein at The Times at 1. Good morning to you all.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Danny. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You are listening to Jane and Fee here on Times Radio.
And between now and 4 o'clock, should jewellery and valuables be taken from asylum seekers to cover the cost of their processing claims? We'll talk to a former Home Office boss on what he makes of the government's plans. Keep up at the back. President Trump now wants his Republican Party to vote to release the Epstein files. The Times woman in Washington, Lara Spirit, will tell us what's happening now. We'll talk to a woman who got out of $40,000 worth of debt in just 16 months. And what do you do with a truly brilliant sports person who doesn't appear to be a team player? We are looking at you, Jude Bellingham.
All after the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. A senior Labour MP has warned of ICE-style raids in Britain under the Home Secretary's sweeping reforms of the asylum system. Shabana Mahmood will tell MPs this afternoon that Britain needs a new approach for refugees arriving on small boats. The Home Secretary plans to impose visa bans on three African countries if they fail to take back illegal migrants. She's also expected to make asylum status temporary, inspired by a policy in Denmark. The senior backbencher Stella Creasy told Times Radio she feared of Donald Trump-style immigration raids in the UK.
If you've been here for 10 years and your children have gone to school in these communities, you've managed to get a job, you've managed to build some sort of life, and then we suddenly say to you, we've unilaterally decided, even though you're a victim of torture, you can go home now. It's very hard to see why anybody would comply with that request willingly.
The chairman of the BBC says it's determined to fight the planned lawsuit from Donald Trump, insisting there's no basis for a defamation case. The US president's threatening to sue for up to $5 billion over the Panorama edit of his speech ahead of the Capitol riots in January 2021. The corporations apologise for what it's called an error of judgment. Meanwhile, all files relating to the dead sex offender Jeffrey Epstein could be released soon after Mr. Trump changed his stance on their publication. Last night, the president urged Republicans to support the disclosure, saying, "We have nothing to hide." Details of Epstein's relationship with Andrew Mountbatten Windsor led to the former prince being stripped of his royal titles. The former US Vice President Mike Pence says there's no better antiseptic than daylight.
I know the president has very strenuously denounced this matter as a hoax. You'd have to talk to people a lot closer to him to know and understand that. I simply know of no reason from our time together in the White House why all these files should not be released.
Poland's prime minister says an explosion on a rail line used to transport aid to Ukraine was an act of sabotage. Damage was reported yesterday morning on part of the track linking the capital Warsaw with its eastern neighbour. It's not yet clear who was responsible, but Polish authorities have detained dozens of people over suspected sabotage since Russia's war began in February of 2022. Hertfordshire Police has agreed to pay £20,000 to a couple they arrested for complaining about their child's school on WhatsApp. Six officers were sent to the home of Times Radio producer Maxie Allen and his partner Rosalind Levine. The force admitted liability for wrongful arrest and detention, but stands by its decision to investigate due to the amount of messages sent. Mr. Allen says he wasn't expecting an apology.
In the final analysis, what they say is they stand by that they had reasonable suspicion because of the reports made by the complainant. But they accept that they essentially didn't have any evidence.
And cold weather alerts have been stepped up across Britain as Arctic air sweeps southwards. Northern England's under an amber alert until Saturday, meaning possible threat to life, while the rest of the country has a less severe yellow warning. There are also Met Office alerts for snow and ice for parts of England and Scotland later this week. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB. Online and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the programme. Jane Garvey, Fee Glover with you until 4 o'clock. The budget still lies tantalisingly just out of reach. How many sleeps have we got now?
It's next Wednesday, isn't it? So I think it would be 8 sleeps to go.
Okay. Full coverage right here on Times Radio. You'll be in the safe hands of Andrew Neil on Budget Day here on Times Radio. But money is on our minds today. We're asking, how much money do you need to feel properly rich in this country in 2025? And you can hear too from a woman who's doing very well on thetimes.com. She's one of the most read articles right now. She's in her 30s. She's a journalist who paid off her family's 40 grand's worth of debt in 16 months. We should say that her partner is an accountant, and I think that will some people listening to the interview might be interested just in that aspect of her story. But she got to a point, Fee, where she just realised, as you'll hear in the interview, that she couldn't sustain a lifestyle that she knew they couldn't afford, and she just couldn't live with the fear of debt, and indeed the debt, the very real amount of debt that they were both in. So they did something about it. She also, to a degree, because she's a social media starlet, she was able to monetize her debt, if that makes any sense. But it's really interesting because some people are able to cope with an amount of debt more than others. Some people think, yeah, okay, I'll really enjoy this holiday, even though I've bunged it all on the card. And then there are others who would say, no, I'm happy with I'll have a week in Skegness because that's what I can afford. We're all very different, aren't we? And that's what makes the world go round.
And wherever you look these days, you are being encouraged to live outside of your means. I think it's only a matter of time before somebody christens their baby Klarna, but it is it is everywhere, isn't it? And it's telling you that you can enjoy today and pay for it tomorrow and you'll be okay. But that is quite a confusing place in your mind, isn't it? Because the old-fashionedness in both of us says no.
Don't do it.
That won't work.
Go for a brisk walk in Britain. You'll enjoy it just as much. 0333 003 2353. Let us know what you think about debt and whether you're averse to it or actually happy to embrace a degree of it. We're not talking about mortgages here. That's very different, obviously. Also on the programme today, the Home Secretary's new Danish-style plan to tackle illegal immigration and to make radical changes to the asylum laws. Is it a betrayal of Labour values, much needed or too little too late? What do you think? Money pouring into the Green Party's coffers. We'll talk about that soon. What are they going to spend it all on? And the Bellingham riddle. Should the England men's football team simply put up with his petulance because he is easily the best player in the squad? Or should he be taught a lesson? In the past, he has been left out, of course. Another day, more endless hours of speculation about the Epstein files. In this week's surprise twist, President Trump is telling Republicans, go right ahead and vote for the release of the files. We don't have anything to hide. What is going on? Lara Spirit will join us later. And Literary Salon Monday, Robbie Millen will bumble through the French windows about 3:30, armed with some erudite chat about books and a dollop of innuendo as well.
A couple of quick hellos that we didn't have time for on Thursday's programme because we had such a busy news agenda, Jane. But Linda, definitely do your very best with Louise Penny's book and get back in touch and let us know if you enjoyed it. And also, Anne, could you send those pictures again? Anne had found Donald Trump in her embers in her wood-burning stove with an uncanny series of photographs of the orange one, literally glowing orange in the embers. because it doesn't always work on radio, but Jane will do her very best with her powers of description. If you could send the photograph again, I think we would all enjoy a little rendition about it. We are 0333 003 2353, and we are Jane and Fee at times.radio.
I tell you what, I'm intrigued by that.
Oh, it was absolutely brilliant. We started off with an incredibly serious and horrendous news story on Thursday, so it wasn't appropriate to go into it then, but bung it to us now, Annie, and we'll try and do our worst or our very best.
Yeah, one of those two things. Right, all that money coming into the Green Party coffers in a moment. First, a quick look at the most read stories on the Times website right now. At number three, we paid off £40,000 worth of debt in 16 months. Here's how. We'll talk to the author of that piece before 2:30. The second most read story, Marlborough College teacher takes his own life after sacking over a school trip. This is about a man called John Wright, who taught physics at Marlborough College for a decade. He was found dead by his wife at their family home. And the most read piece on the Times website is what it takes to be well off in Britain today. It's the inaugural Times Wealth Survey, based on a poll of more than 4,000 people, reveals that nearly half of us, 45%, feel financially vulnerable. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription, and if you don't have one, you can get one. Just go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
It is nearly 10 minutes past two. Now, does this win you over?
Why is everything so our wages are our rivers are swimming in, and most politicians, they're full of it too.
Order! Order!
And here's the truth. Those same politicians sold you out. The people you voted for, your supposed representatives, they stopped serving you a long time ago and now entirely serve big business. And once you see it, everything clicks. Follow the money and you will see both Starmer and Farage whining and dining hedge fund billionaires, oil and gas companies, arms traders, same dealers, same game. So what am I going to do that's different? I'm Zach Polanski.
Well, it's got an urgent beat to it, hasn't it? And it's working for some, as support for the Green Party has surged since the self-described eco-populist Zach Polanski was elected as leader, raising over £4 million from membership fees in the last 10 weeks alone. But how are they going to spend the money? Where's it come from? Let's talk to Daisy Eastlake, political reporter for The Times. Daisy, can you put this into perspective for us and compare it to how the party has usually done in terms of funding?
Yeah, so this is double what they normally make. So they normally are valued at about 5 million a year, and they've made at least 4 million in the last 10 weeks alone. So they've basically doubled their finances in a very short period of time. So it's absolutely massive for the capability that it gives the Green Party in their electioneering and their reach. Yeah, so it's a really, really big deal for them. It's the first in their history.
What does it buy?
So I spoke to them last week, and they said that some of the things that they're really looking at doing is investing in things that lots of other parties kind of take for granted. So a digital canvassing system is one of them, so that when they knock on doors, they don't have to write everything down on pieces of paper on clipboards. But another one is things like proper polling. So I spoke to Harriet Lamb, who's the chief executive of the Greens, and she said that normally they beg borrow their polling from other sources or from ones that are already taking place, whereas now with this money, they can invest in proper polling. They also want to grow their staff, so they want to be working towards having 150 members of staff by the end of 2026. And in true Green Party fashion, one of the first roles that they're hiring for is a diversity, equality and inclusion manager. So they've got big things on their agenda.
Well, there will be plenty of those managers looking for a job at the moment, won't they? Because they are facing a tougher time in certain other political spheres. Can you tell us a little bit about who this new membership is? Is it possible to know that?
Yeah, so definitely. So the most marked thing is that the Greens have become, for the first time, the most popular party amongst 18 to 24-year-olds. Obviously, they've always done well in that group anyway, but it was Labour's stronghold. The youth always tended to vote Labour, whereas now this is suggesting that, you know, people are drifting away from Labour and towards Greens for the strong left alternative. So a big chunk of it will be 18 to 24-year-olds. But also, a lot of this is down to social media. So they've got a lot of their popularity online. So although we don't know the breakdown specifically, we do know that that is where the volume is coming from, because so much of Zach Polanski's content, so much of the Greens content is coming up across so many people's feed that it's driven a massive surge in membership. I mean, 78,000 people signed up to be members of the Green Party in October alone. So the surge is going to be pretty big across a lot of different demographics.
Yeah, but I mean, it really is significant, isn't it? And it's not because Zach Polanski is classically green. It's quite the opposite, in fact, isn't it?
Yeah, so actually one thing that is quite noticeable is that of all of the topics that he's talking about to these groups, that on social media, in crowds, in audiences, environmentalism is not really high up there on his list. He's talking about Palestine, he's talking about cost of living is a massive one, he's talking about immigration and attitudes towards race and, you know, diversity. He's talking about lots of issues that actually don't really touch on the environment. And I put this to him a few weeks ago, and he said his explanation was that the Greens always poll very strongly on the environment. Everyone trusts them as being a party that they know that they can trust with environmental policies, but they don't poll as highly on some other issues. They are known as a bit of a single issue party. And so part of his whole drive of what he's talking about is to shake that up a little bit. So he's talking about these other issues, and that seems to be what's winning lots of new people over.
And also, Daisy, I mean, let's just be honest about this. He is a different type of person to see on social media by comparison to the other leaders of political parties, isn't he? Just the way he stands, what he wears, the way he speaks, as we heard in that clip, the kind of beat, the adrenaline rush that is put behind his social media appearances. And it sometimes looks like he is actually a different species to some of the other leaders.
Yeah, I mean, if there's one thing you can say about Zach Polanski is that he definitely has an attraction on social media, particularly on centre-left social media, in a way that maybe back in 2017, 2019, Corbyn would have had. He's very appealing. He doesn't muddle his words. He will say what he thinks openly when people ask him about it. He makes a lot of this social media content that is quite glossy, it's all aesthetic. He's going on stage with Rizzle Kicks. He's wearing like a casual suit. He's projecting this entire message of making hope normal again, which is his slogan, being like kind of relatable, but also appealing to that social media generation who also care about the way that something is presented to them, not just what the content of it actually is.
For those people listening this afternoon who don't know who Mr. Rizzle Kicks is, Daisy.
they are a British hip-hop duo from the 2000s, but they used to be big fans of Corbyn. And so the shift towards... He went out on stage with them in Bristol for a concert, and he was playing a game of call and response with the audience, saying, oh, if I say tax that, you say rich. And they were all loving it. So it's definitely a shift that the space that Corbyn once had is now Polanski's.
The one thing that we should say, though, is that he is in that position where he can make promises and aim high, knowing that actually he is unlikely to be tested on the efficacy of his thought leadership for at least a couple of years. Would that be fair to say, Daisy?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the election is very far away, and I think even though they're doing very well in the polls and their membership is surging, the impact that the Greens are more likely to have is that they will split the vote rather than win the seat. And I think that, you know, with everything in politics, there's lots of focus on reform, there's lots of focus on Labour. It's quite easy to sit on TikTok or to sit on Instagram and to present your view on a certain thing without having necessarily the backlash. And that's potentially a challenge that the Greens will face in the coming years, is whether or not their economic policies and projections about cost of living can actually ever be delivered.
Sure. But he is undoubtedly an interesting and fun voice to have on the political stage at the moment, isn't he? Thank you for talking to us. That's Davy Eastlake, political reporter for The Times, and we are discussing Zach Polanski. If you're one of those people who has just joined, tell us about the impact that he in particular has had on that decision.
It's hard to dislike the emphasis on hope, isn't it? Because the other parties are quite gloomy. And here's at least a burst of something. not quite sure what, but energy, yeah, and positivity.
No, I think it is a very welcome addition, yeah, at the moment. And because everybody's going to start courting that very, very young vote in a way that policies haven't courted that young vote over the last 20 years in British politics. So he is speaking a language that the other political parties just have to learn.
And the 16-year-olds with the vote might very well be drawn. Yeah, absolutely. Let us know what you think. 0333 003 2353. Just a few thoughts from you on money. Sylvia says, a walk in the Yorkshire Dales and a card with no debt. That's my idea of heaven.
You come to the right show.
You really have, Sylvia. A brisk walk in the Yorkshire Dales and no debt. Actually, Fi and I both be on board with that. And Andrew says, am I rich? This is because we're talking about how much money you need these days in the UK to feel rich. That's after a quarter to four this afternoon on the programme. Andrew says, am I rich? Well, I don't know, because I don't know when or how I'm going to die. The house is paid for. I've got a few quid in the bank, but will I need a private medicine or 5 years in care at around 1,500 quid a week? And my investments could go pear-shaped overnight. Now, if my pension were guaranteed, like everybody who works in the Treasury, I could more easily answer the question. That's interesting, Andrew, and I suspect you speak for quite a few listeners there.
Coming up, 16 months to get out of £40,000 of debt. Could you manage it? Our next guest did. You're listening to Jane and Fi on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The State of It is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Join political heavyweights Stephen Swinford, Caroline Wheeler, Gabriel Pogrand and Patrick Maguire.
Only a very small handful of the people that I go out for lunch with will actually want to have a glass of wine. Nigel Farage is definitely one of them.
No party loyalty, just the inside track on the decisions and policymakers that shape your life. The State of It is available to listen now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
When they say, don't get me anything, you know what they really mean. Give the birthday gift they really want from Hotel Chocolat. Cakes transformed into chocolate for those who choose dessert over a starter, or, if they like it nutty, a box bursting with pralines and epically crunchy whole nut chocolates. Add a gift bag and a complimentary gift sleeve and make it a birthday moment. Find the gift you know they'll love in store or online at Hotel Chocolat.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.5% AER variable. That includes a 2% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
For a whole year, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that once-in-a-lifetime adventure. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.41% gross. Terms apply.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Jane Garvey and Fi Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. Choose from thousands of products. Wickes have options to suit every budget. Plus, with great offers now on, it's the perfect time to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom. Find your nearest showroom at wickes.co.uk.
Just in case you think we're in danger of becoming a little too green positive, let's bring you this thought from James, who says, my direct experience of the Greens in Bristol, where they run the city council, I think, is that they haven't cared about spending money efficiently, but have cared very much about playing politics. I found them disingenuous and irresponsible. I was a supporter, not again, he says. Right. So let's talk about that young woman, actually, in her 30s, who found herself in £40,000 worth of debt. Well, that was actually her and her partner, as you'll hear in a moment. And then as a couple, they decided they couldn't bear this anymore and they needed to get out of the debt and just start all over again. The woman involved is Megan Archer-Fox. She's in her 30s and she's written about her experience for the new and improved Times Money section. So here she is explaining to me just how it feels now to be out of debt.
Very freeing. Sometimes it feels like it's all been a bit of a dream. Like, obviously, I remember being in debt and how horrible it was and how horrible I felt. But now people ask me how it feels and I sort of think not much different, but also very different. Sorry, I hope that makes sense. It's just extremely freeing, and like I feel like so much has opened up to us now.
And when things were at their very worst, was it something, I don't know, that popped into your head every single morning as soon as you woke up?
Yes, yeah, it was. It was like that feeling, how I always describe it, is like the first moment you wake up and your eyes open, and your thoughts haven't really settled for the day. And then when they do settle, it was like the first thing I thought of, and like my heart would just sink like every time. And I thought, oh, like, because life just felt great, like, you know, two lovely children and my partner and a good job and house and everything and, you know, lovely friends and family. But then this one thing, like, was just there, like, always at the side. And, yeah, it was horrible.
What was the situation? How much money did you owe?
So I owed £22,500 and my partner owed just less than £16,900. So, and together, the overall total was just under £40,000 of debt, £39,390 to be precise, which was between the two of us, it was 6 credit cards and 2 overdrafts.
And you're both educated people in your 30s with jobs. I mean, you are a journalist and your partner is an accountant.
Yes, that's right.
So, I mean, lots of people obviously are going to say, what? He's an accountant. She's a journalist. How did this happen?
It's funny, isn't it? Because, I'm not trying to be arrogant, but I think we're both very good at our respective jobs. You know, he's very logical. He's a numbers man. I'm very creative. I love to write. We've both been doing what we're doing for years, like more than a decade. And it's different, isn't it? Because, like, you can be good at your job and then something in your personal life is just sort of falling apart a little bit. And that's how it felt. Like we were working hard and then we wanted to just enjoy ourselves at the same time. So we'd go on holiday and we'd have dinners out and we'd say yes to everything, but we weren't watching like what was coming in versus what was coming out. We were very like, oh, you know, you only live once, let's enjoy ourselves. We work so hard. Like, why should we have to save for that? We could just pop it on the credit card, sort it out another day. It was very that sort of mindset.
And this was a mindset that presumably you'd had what for most of your life?
Yes. So when I first started, when I was 18, and I got an interest-free student overdraft, and that was a very gradual start. Like when you think, oh, I'll sort it out when I get a job, because you're 18. Well, I was 18. I thought it's not going to be a problem yet. But then as I got through my 20s, like you add little bits on, like, oh, the odd holiday here on a credit card, or I'll just put the odd dinner on it. And then suddenly it became more of a problem. But once I suddenly started looking at it, it was a much bigger problem than I thought I could deal with.
And your partner, and I guess in a way, lots of people choose partners with a similar approach to life as their own. And David, your accountant partner, also enjoyed, well, living, as you say, living life to the full.
Yes. Yeah, we both did. And I think, and that's what we sort of enjoyed about each other. We both got out of quite serious relationships before we met each other. And it was just like an instant like connection where we just loved, you know, doing stuff together, like having meals and having fun and going out, nights out, seeing friends, day trips, holidays. Like we loved that whatever we said to the other one would be like, yeah, let's do it. And that was quite a nice feeling. But obviously we took it a little bit too far.
So when was the moment where you just sat together and just realised that actually it couldn't go on?
So I think we'd both been feeling it for a long time, but we hadn't really, like, I can't think how long, but we hadn't really been very good at talking to each other about it, but it all sort of came to a head. It was in May 2024 and it just been his birthday. And I think we both just sat down one night and we were just like, we can't keep going on. I think one of my credit cards was about to max out. The others were very near their limit. He was in the same sort of situation. And we were thinking, oh, should we get another credit card? And then we both were like, oh, we can't keep doing this. Like, and we had our kids to think about then. So I think that was the point where we were both like, we need to do something.
Did you ever have any trouble getting credit cards? Because you had a lot. There were never any barriers at all. You just applied and got one.
Yeah, surprisingly not. Like, I've heard of people who really struggle to get credit or loans or approval for anything. But I don't know if, I mean, I've never missed a payment. I don't know if that helped, but I just managed to get credit so easily. Like, I could do balance transfers and money transfers, and I could take out loans. The interest rates were quite high towards the end, like towards when we started paying it off. But yeah, I feel like I could easily get quite a lot of debt. Like every time I applied to increase my overdraft, that was always accepted.
Yeah, okay. So would you argue actually that some of these institutions, that the finance companies, they bear some responsibility, or is it all entirely your own and indeed your partner's?
No, I take a lot of responsibility, obviously. I spent this money, you know, I took out all this credit, and so does my partner David. But I do think some of it should fall on the banks too. I mean, because they could see if they had looked, or were they looking, I don't know, they could see how much debt I was in, and they could see like what my salary was, and it was just an unreal amount. That I remember applying for one credit card, and I think I was on a salary at the time of like £24,000 a year, and they gave me a £10,000 limit just like that. And
wow.
I was only in my early 20s. I already had debt, like around 10, 12 grand of debt at the time. And I just thought, like, I don't know, I just thinking back now, I'm like, that's just, I don't think that was right.
Right. I mean, I'm astonished, but I'll take your word for it. Honestly, it terrifies me, the whole thing. Okay, so you and David decide it can't go on. You have now paid off the debt. How?
So I really think our mindset was a huge part of it, because we'd spent so long thinking, oh no, you know, we're not going to be able to do it. It'd be too difficult. We'll be living in misery for years while we pay it off. All that sort of thing. But once we were like, no, come on, like we actually sat down, we added it all up. We thought, yes, let's do this. We made like a little, very simple budget. And it was that mindset of keeping each other going and sort of looking at our goal and thinking like, we can do this, and thinking of our kids. We cut back on quite a few things. So I stopped getting like, I love getting my nails done. I stopped that. I stopped getting like fancy haircuts. We stopped going out to eat so much. Food was our huge thing. But we kept little treats. Like we had like a weekly takeaway, but we tried to do it cheaply. So we would keep ourselves going, so we wouldn't feel so down about it all. We tried making extra money on the side as well. And yeah, just anything we could, but it was the main thing I really do believe was the mindset. Like, cause there were a few months where I thought, wow, the debt's not going down. This is so hard, but it was going down. And then we kept reminding each other that we could do this.
And your mindset that you've already told us about, has it changed forever? Do you think there is any chance at all that you and David might end up in a similar position in the future?
I firmly believe that I will never, ever go back into debt. And I know that's quite a wild sort of statement, but I remember how it felt. And I remember like crying, like real tears. Like I remember our sort of fraught conversations about it. Like it was something that no one knew about it, but it was something that just hung over us. And we didn't speak about it really to anyone, but it was just such a horrible sort of secret we were keeping. And I could never feel like that again. So that's the one big drive that would absolutely keep me out of it, and David as well.
Well, that is Megan Archer-Fox. She's been through it. She says she's most definitely out the other side, got rid of that 40 grand's worth of debt. Some of you are taking quite a brisk attitude here. This listener says, I'm sorry, but adults have to take responsibility for their own spending and saving habits. I wouldn't disagree, but on the other hand, I was really shocked that somebody on an annual salary of 24 grand was offered 10 grand on a credit card. How can that be? It's crazy, isn't it?
It doesn't seem viable. But also, I think we're of the generation where we do regard debt in a different way. And I think if you've been offered such massive debt in order for tertiary education to be available to you, I think you do just have a different mindset about what it is. You've taken on an astonishing amount of debt very early on in your life, completely and utterly commended to you by the state, the university, probably your parents and everybody else around you. It's just different. Mm. Would you have even thought about taking on 50 grand of debt when you were 17, 18 years old?
No, I mean, I was called in to see the bank manager when I was a student. I mean, called in. I had to sit in the bank manager's office because I'd gone, I think, 300 quid overdrawn. And I was spending it on books. I wouldn't mind. Crazy times.
She certainly is a feckless woman. Coming up, no kissing, no rings, no processing down the aisle, no fun. Why same-sex blessings could have strict rules in the Church of England. First, it's James Kitchen with the news.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon.
Reform UK's deputy leader says the Home Secretary won't be able to get her proposed overhaul of asylum rules through the Commons. Shabana Mahmood plans to make refugee status temporary and restrict how the European Convention on Human Rights is applied to asylum cases. But Richard Tice told Times Radio her words won't translate into action.
For all the best will in the world, she's not going to be able to deliver it because of membership of the European Convention on Human Rights, and already we're seeing parts of her own party rebelling against it. I mean, the sort of language she's using here in November, when we were using similar language 2 months ago, the Labour Party was describing us as racist bigots. I mean, talk about hypocrisy.
The chairman of the BBC has told staff Donald Trump has no basis for a defamation case over the edit of a Panorama documentary. The US president's threatened to sue the corporation for up to $5 billion for the way the broadcaster spliced together one of his speeches. Meanwhile, Mr. Trump says he wants Republicans to vote to release the files relating to Jeffrey Epstein because he says the party has nothing to hide. It marks a significant U-turn for the president, who previously dismissed demands to publish the Justice Department documents. The ousted Prime Minister of Bangladesh, Sheikh Hasina, has been sentenced to death for crimes against humanity. A court revealed conversations of her directing security officers to drop bombs from helicopters on protesters at a student-led uprising last year. And amber cold health alerts have been issued across large areas of the UK until Saturday. Sub-zero temperatures are expected during the first major cold snap of the year. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective, and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth, and the joy that meets you there. Silversea brings you closer to the rare, the remote, and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
It's easy to forget just how crazy things have been over the past couple of years. Every day we wake up to something new, tariffs and taxes on anything and everything. It's tempting to put your hands in your ears and go, la 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 la, I can't hear you, until it's all over. But you know what's the best response to crazy times? A plan for your money. And Quilter can help. Because let's face it, there's probably going to be some crazy times ahead too. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. There's over 70 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the spend and save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
I'll be very careful. The microphones are on. Ooh, kids.
Just having a little chuckle there with John Pienaar. Must stop that. Not here to enjoy ourselves.
Yes, careless talk. It's 24 minutes to 3 o'clock. Hello, John. How are you? Did you have a good weekend?
It was nice. It was restful. Just stuff at home, which is the way I like it a lot of the time. And now we are back at home in our office and just dealing with more stuff. Like the statement coming, I think it may well be from what we hear, quite late on in the afternoon, maybe towards 6 o'clock or so, depending on how other stuff goes. But it's going to be, isn't it, behind the budget in a couple of weeks' time. This is a huge political event. I mean, the way people see this government, I say people, a lot of people see the government, is going to be moulded largely by what we hear this afternoon. It's been heavily troubled. We've got a fair idea what's coming. And it is a woman, a daughter of Pakistani migrants, who's now the Home Secretary, who takes, you know, is not at all shy about presenting herself as very tough on asylum seeking and migration, and with plans today to match. We'll see how it goes down on her own side. Some of this stuff may well be swallowed by a lot of Labour MPs. Some will have to swallow harder than others. I mean, I'm looking at some of the proposals we got here for rounding up people from countries which are deemed unsafe when they're allowed into this country and then deemed safe. If you're going to throw those people out, because a lot of them are talking about throwing them out, they won't want to go, then aren't we talking then about those ICE-type vans, you know, the Trump-style vans, rounding people up and maybe holding them, presumably holding them in detention until they're thrown out of the country? I'm guessing a lot on the Labour side in particular are going to find that hard to swallow. No doubt others on the left, Greens and Liberal Democrats, will certainly hate it. But, you know, there's the Home Secretary saying, unless we take tough action now, then the sort of hostility we've got and unhappiness about asylum and migration is going to sort of spread into a wider hostility and racism towards more people, including people who were born and raised in this country but don't happen to be white. So there's a lot for these MPs to tug on in this debate, and we'll have a good go at all of that with Mike Tapp. When I say Mike Tapp, I'm not sure he's going to be joining us, but I know that David Normanton, who's a former head of the Home Office, he is going to be joining us. Lord Dubs, who fights for refugees. Tony Vaughan, the Labour MP, who said he doesn't like this stuff, and others.
Look forward to it, John. Thank you very much. John starts at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Thank you for all of your text messages so far this afternoon too. We are 0333 003 2353. We were talking in the last half an hour of the programme about the appeal of Jack Polansky and the amazing amount of money that has come through new membership to the Green Party since he became the leader. And one of our correspondents says Jack has the same accent and voice as most of the other politicians, so his background probably isn't that different. Rich parents, gap year. He sounds like a younger Keir trying to hang out at a beach party in Bali. Good luck to him. We need a new generation of fake leaders.
Oh, dear. Cynicism is alive and well.
It is, it is. Now, at the moment, if you're a member of a Church of England congregation and you're in a same-sex relationship and you decide you want to have and to hold for better or for worse, well, you can't have a wedding ceremony like a heterosexual couple. You can have a blessing as part of an existing service, but it's not exactly equality. If you can't fill the entire church with your family and friends, choose your own hymns, your own vows, and when you want a tiny bridesmaid or page boy to burst into tears or have a massive hissy fit. But now the times, they are a-changing, and the General Synod has backed a trial of blessing services, not part of another church service, but gay couples still won't be allowed to kiss, exchange rings, read vows, or walk down the aisle. Well, let's talk now to Charlie Bell, a gay Anglican priest in the Diocese of Southwark. A very good afternoon to you, Charlie Bell. How do you feel about this?
Hi, nice to speak to you. This is the Church of England tying itself up in knots again, I think. The devil is in the detail, and none of it makes much sense unless you're kind of caught up so much in the detail that that those of us who care about these kind of things are. I just feel like it's another own goal for the church, a failure to offer what is essentially a pastoral response to people in same-sex relationships. And we seem to be so grudging in our willingness to do anything whatsoever.
It does seem a little bit odd. I don't know whether or not you can better explain to us the reasoning behind the detailed decisions that have been taken. Why would it be difficult to allow a gay couple to choose their own hymns, to choose their own vows, to actually just walk down the aisle? Why are those things of greater significance to just being in church in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially down to what looks too much like a wedding, or what might appear too much like a wedding, because the Church of England's position, which I feel is wrong, but it's the current position, is that marriage is between a man and a woman. And so therefore, what we can't offer is marriage or anything that looks too much like marriage. And what these documents have said is anything you're offering shouldn't look too much like marriage. And what the bishops have then said is, well, let's not offer too much at all. I think there's a much more nuanced way of doing this. And many of us will simply go ahead and offer services for people and use our sort of theological and pastoral nous to just offer things which are entirely in keeping with what we're allowed.
Sure, but won't that end up making you feel bad and everybody in the church feel a bit bad? You know, were you to allow a gay couple to choose their own hymn, to walk down the aisle, maybe just half the aisle or whatever it is, you're all going to end up feeling like you're having to kind of cheat your own system. So that's quite bad as well, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you have a weak House of Bishops. You know, I think there's what's being presented as the decision of the Church of England is really the decision of a House of Bishops. And the House has felt threatened by a large group of very well-funded Conservatives who have threatened at each stage of the way that if this happens, then they all come down on them like a ton of bricks, take them to court and all the rest of it. And I think the bishops have folded at the last minute, which is a bit of a shame, really. But yeah, it's not ideal. But I'm a priest. My first responsibility is to be pastoral to the people that come to me. And if I can offer them something which I think is in keeping and in keeping both with the spirit and the letter of the law, which we're obliged to follow as priests, then I'd be very happy to do it.
Mm. Might the installation of Sarah Mullally as Archbishop of Canterbury change any of this, do you think?
Possibly. I mean, I think it's difficult because we don't want to put so much on her shoulders as the new Archbishop. And the Archbishop doesn't have a hugely executive role in these decisions. But of course, the tone is set by the new Archbishop. And I would hope Sarah has been responsible for many of the really positive changes through leading this project recently. And so I would feel that Sarah, at least from her kind of pastoral sense, would want us to be able to find a way through this. And so I'm hopeful that we'll be able to do that. But we can't just blame it all on whoever's Archbishop of Canterbury. Yeah.
How are you yourself judged, if in fact you feel judged at all, by those bishops who you've referred to as the ones who don't want to embrace same-sex relationships in the Church of England?
Well, it's a bit tedious as a priest in the Church of England to constantly have one's priesthood challenged and indeed the sort of faithfulness of gay lesbian couples challenged all the time when, you know, there are plenty of gay priests. I don't think my diocese would function without them. And you know, we get on with it day after day. There are plenty of gay and lesbian members of the congregations who are just doing their thing, getting on with being members of the church, doing all the kind of interesting and dull things that members of the Church of England end up getting on with. So in a sense, it just feels like an endless fight to prove that you're worth having at the table. And that feels to me to be not terribly Christian.
Yeah. When those bishops do eventually go, do you imagine that the Church of England naturally evolves? Is it a question of age that is defining people's opinions?
It's tricky. I don't think it's just about age. I think it's about power and control and who's in the driving seat. And the Church of England's always been a really wide vehicle. It's had people from all kinds of different theological persuasions. But the arc of history on this is pretty clear. I think most denominations are moving towards increased openness to LGBT people. Most are moving towards openness to at least blessings, if not marriage. So I think we'll get there. It's just, it feels to me how much pastoral damage do we have to do in the meantime before we get there? And I hope that there's not too much more of it, although with the current decisions by the House of Bishops, it's hard to know exactly how long it will take.
Sure. I mean, there is a move in the other direction, Charlie, isn't there? The African churches certainly wouldn't agree with your last sentiment that the times are changing. And is it an inevitability that schism will just become even more of a real and, I suppose, recognised thing?
Yeah, I mean, I was at a conference just a week or so ago with a group of Anglicans from around the world, including a large number from what's often described as the global south, including Africa and other parts of the communion. I think the situation in the Anglican communion is more complicated or more complex than we're often led to believe. There are a number of churches in parts of Africa that would be much more sort of progressive or liberal on this issue than we might otherwise think. So you know, I think it's complicated. I think there's been a schism for some time. I think there have been churches that really cannot go along with the way that the Church of England is moving on this. But I don't know if that's always theological. Sometimes that's sociocultural and so on. And I think one of the most important things for us to do as a church is to have serious conversations about this from a kind of sociocultural as well as a theological standpoint, because we're not going to agree, and that's, in a sense, we've got to find out whether we can cope with not agreeing and actually be honest with one another about the fact that we don't agree.
Yep. Can we leave on a slightly more positive note? And I wonder whether you have got a very full diary of these blessing services ahead of you this year. And, you know, can you just tell us what makes people feel welcome in your church when they decide they want to make that loving commitment to their partner?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that surprises me or makes me I suppose, pleased in a sense, is the number of people who don't know that the Church of England doesn't do this stuff in the first place, and then are slightly surprised when they come and are told, well, you know, we've got to slightly play the game and do this and so on. Most people just want to come to church, celebrate their relationship in front of God, in the same way that heterosexual couples do. And so as far as I'm concerned, if we can offer them that, and if we can offer them then the opportunity to come and to pray together, to be blessed, and to celebrate with family and friends before a God who created each and every one of us in God's own image. Well, as far as I'm concerned, that's the church doing the role the church is called to do.
Good to talk to you this afternoon. Thank you very much indeed for your time. That is Charlie Bell, who is an Anglican priest in the Diocese of Southwark.
Football next, and whisper it, England men are really very good, and there's even a faint chance they could win the World Cup next summer.
Way too long, Jane. You're the funny juice.
No, it's true. But they do have one issue, big ego issue, involving a certain Mr. Bellingham. That's next here on Times Radio. It's Jane and Fee with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with IG, the champions of zero commission investing. Every Monday to Thursday afternoon, John Pienaar brings you a perfectly balanced portfolio of up-to-the-minute news, unrivaled analysis and expert opinion. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive, every Monday to Thursday afternoon from 4 on Times Radio with IG. Trade, invest, progress. Search IG.com to find out more. Capital at risk, other fees may apply.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programmes and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
Mr. Thing loves winter. Fluffy slippers, hot chalk, the heating on. Uh-oh, that didn't sound good. Looks like the boiler's packed in. Thankfully, Mr. Thing has British Gas Home Care cover, which means unlimited repairs for his boiler, heating, electrics and more. And right now, it's 50% off for the first 6 months. Search British Gas Home Care, one of the ways we're taking care of things. T's and C's apply. No claims within the first 14 days. Ends 1st of December. New customers only. Remaining 6 months at full price.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
A listener says, I am gay and I'm so thankful I'm not religious. The church wants to avoid looking homophobic whilst acting in a totally homophobic way. It's insulting. The irony is that there are plenty of straight people who aren't religious at all but do want to get married in a church just for the pictures, and who questions them? That's an interesting point. If you want to react to that or anything else you've heard this afternoon, 0333 003 2353. And so to England and the football last night. England through to the World Cup finals next summer, and actually they've been really, really good. They have won every single one of their qualifiers. They haven't conceded a goal. But there is an issue surrounding star player Jude Bellingham. He was substituted last night, and his body language afterwards, and it was in the 84th minute, was, to put it mildly, not positive. He did start in the 2-0 win against Albania. Thomas Tuchel, the German manager, said he hadn't seen Jude Bellingham's reaction.
I will have a look at it, but yeah, that's not the image that we want to transport, because we feel that everyone is committed and everyone accepts also a tough decision, be it before the match or in the match, and it excludes no one. It is about standards and about level, and it's a commitment to each other and respect to each other.
Thomas Tuchel, the England manager. Well, Dr. Misha Jervis is a sports psychologist who has worked with the FA and with professional clubs as well. Dr. Jervis, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Now, I was particularly struck by an image I've seen in the Times today of Jude Bellingham on the bench after he'd been subbed last night, and he is slumped in his ultra-comfortable leather effect-looking chair. He looks miserable. He looks highly hacked off to have been pulled off the pitch. He's sitting next to the utterly professional, cool, calm and collected Jordan Henderson, who always looks absolutely impeccable and positive and very much a team player. What do you think about the way he reacted last night?
Goodness me, there's a lot of judgment in what you've just said.
Well, take me on. Go on.
Well, I think I might. I think we have to ask different questions, actually. And I think the question we need to ask is about how he was feeling. So, and what he was feeling in the moment has been labelled as something to do with ego, to do with disrespect, to do with all of those things. But I'm not sure that that's what's going on. I think that in that moment, maybe he had really set himself up to go, I'm going to play the whole game, and was disappointed in himself that he wasn't able to do that. I don't think it was about disrespecting anyone. I think he was feeling maybe hurt, maybe frustrated. And guess what? He's human, and his body leaked those emotions. And what happened after that is that, you know, people in your profession have turned it into something, created a tsunami out of a very genuine human moment, I think, where he was upset. And I think if you asked him, he was probably upset at himself.
Yeah, that's interesting, because he had been booked in the game, hadn't he? And I understand that there was a precautionary element to subbing him.
Yeah, for sure. And listen, you know, Thomas Tuchel is, of course, absolutely within his rights to make the decisions about who's on the pitch and who isn't. And that's absolutely indisputable. But I think that the moments that seem to be condemning Jude Bellingham are moments where actually he's showing that he really wants to be on the pitch. He really wants to play. He really wants to be there. And don't you want players who are feeling that?
Sometimes when he's playing, he gives off a slightly, and you can take me on this as well, a slightly negative energy when, for example, he puts a pass through that another player can't or doesn't connect with, and he can look incredibly huffy and a slight sort of, ugh, why are these other people not quite as good as I am? Do you never see that in him?
But you're assuming he's thinking, why are these people not as good as I am? That's an assumption. Maybe he's feeling, oh, God, I wish that could connected. Maybe he's feeling something very different.
So how do you treat special players like him in a team of other people who are also really good, but perhaps not as good as him?
Well, listen, I think that, you know, the England team is full of special people, because you don't get to be in the England setup if you're not. I think it's about having open and honest conversations with him about what he was feeling, about what was happening for him, making sure that the connections within the team are still really, really strong. And players will probably understand that emotion, because probably they've experienced it themselves. Maybe it's about how in that micro moments he manages those feelings. And maybe there's some work to be done on just kind of maybe changing his body language a little bit on purpose.
So that's interesting. You think his fellow professionals will be much more forgiving than those of us who, let's face it, are never going to represent England at anything?
I genuinely do, because I think they know what it feels like to come off on a game when they're feeling like they want to do something, like they want to show something. And for Jude Bellingham, listen, this was the first England start he's had in a really, really long time, coming off the back of injury. That game probably meant an awful lot more to him than possibly we are understanding, because the narrative around, oh, well, we'd already qualified, the job was done and all the rest of it, that's not his story. His story is, how do I make this game really good? How do I make sure that I offer my best performance? How do I do all of these things? And the fact that he has those high personal standards is probably what's making him a really good player, because without them, he maybe isn't the person that we want him to be anyway.
In setups like this, do some players simply get more attention than others because they require it? They need to be properly nurtured and they need to be looked after in a way that someone who perhaps is more at ease with themselves for whatever reason, they can just get on with it.
Well, of course, you know, everybody needs different things. You know, a team is not one size fits all. And I guess it's the role of the staff, the sports psychologists, to kind of recognise and understand what these players need and figure out how to work with them.
Next summer isn't that far away. We do know that perhaps we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves, but England's qualification journey has been a really, really smooth one. It's been incredibly impressive, in fact. People are now going to genuinely start talking about them as prospective winners. So Thomas Tuchel has to treat Bellingham and the rest of the players incredibly carefully, doesn't he? High stakes here.
Well, of course, the media hype, you lovely people, create the media hype, and it's already started, but it's always like that. And I think the thing is, when you're in, when you're at a World Cup, and I've been at World Championships and European Championships with England teams, it's really about trying to keep the noise at bay and people recognising that that is all it is. It is noise. And how you manage the moments and the important people are actually the people who are on that very, very special journey with you, because they're the people that can help you. And the other stuff is just noise.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. That was interesting. I don't think she's a big fan of the media. Dr. Misha Jervis, a sports psychologist. But on the other hand, the media can be harsh. I mean, do you remember when David Beckham, remember what happened when he missed and everything, only got sent off that game against Argentina?
Well, his world turned, didn't
terrible.
It? And everyone turned against
What's
him.
What happened to him?
And I think he's done all right in the end.
Kind of fought back, didn't he?
But it's an interesting point, isn't it, that actually we just say the media, because when somebody on a sports pitch does something wrong, it is the whole media that goes in, isn't it?
To be honest, it usually is.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Fair point. 1-0 for Dr. Jervis.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
One of our listeners agrees with you, though, calling him a petulant Percy, Jane. It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Coming up in the next hour, should jewellery and valuables be taken from asylum seekers to cover their processing claims? We're going to talk to a former Home Office boss on what he makes of the government's immigration plans. Why is President Trump now encouraging his party to vote to release the Epstein files? The Times' woman in Washington, Lara Spirit, will join us live. And our literary salon opens its doors, the lights go down, and we also bring you all of the best of advice in money matters. James Kitchen has the 3 o'clock news.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The Home Secretary will lay out sweeping reforms to the asylum system later, despite growing concern from within her own party. The changes to be announced by Shabana Mahmood include lengthening the period a refugee has to wait before being able to claim permanent settlement from 5 to 20 years. Some Labour backbenchers have branded the proposals divisive, but the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says the reforms will have Tory support, despite them being too limited.
I do welcome the government's announcements. It is nowhere near enough. We're going to work with them to try and get this through. Because what I know is that a lot of Labour backbenchers hate this stuff. We've already had about 10 of them come out to criticise their own government. They're going to need us if this is actually going to work.
The chairman of the BBC says it's determined to fight the planned lawsuit from Donald Trump, insisting there's no basis for a defamation case. The US president's threatening to sue for up to $5 billion over the Panorama edit of his speech ahead of the Capitol riots in January 2021. The corporations apologize for what it's called an error of judgment. Meanwhile, Mr. Trump says he wants Republicans to vote to release the files relating to Jeffrey Epstein because he says the party has nothing to hide. It marks a significant U-turn for the president, who previously dismissed demands to publish the Justice Department documents. Former ABC News correspondent Tom Rivers told Times Radio Mr. Trump is willing to burn figures on both sides of the political divide.
He says he's innocent. He hasn't done anything wrong. The fact that there could be some Republican donors that he may be wanting to protect, we don't know. But we are heading toward the stage of let the chips fall where they may. And this is going to burn people on both sides of the political divide in America if, in fact, all of this information gets out into the public domain.
The ousted Prime Minister of Bangladesh, who's been sentenced to death for crimes against humanity, says the verdict is biased and politically motivated. A court revealed conversations of Sheikh Hasina directing security officers to drop bombs from helicopters on protesters at a student-led uprising last year. The aunt of the Labour MP, Tulip Siddiq, wasn't at the trial, having fled to India. The international law specialist, Toby Cadman, is concerned the verdict could spell trouble.
There will be those supporters who come out supporting the verdict as the right verdict, and there will be Sheikh Hasina's supporters that will criticise the verdict. What we hope is that it doesn't turn violent and doesn't send Bangladesh back into a system of instability.
In the past few minutes, agency workers have joined Birmingham's bin strikes. The Unite Union says the walkouts could continue beyond May's local elections unless a deal is reached. Staff refuse collectors have been staging all-out action since March in a row over jobs and pay. Birmingham City Council says the service needs to be transformed. And there are calls for emergency funds from the government to help clean up huge amounts of rubbish in a field in Oxfordshire. The mountain of waste next to the River Cherwell near Kidlington, now 60 metres long, is believed to be the work of fly-tipping gangs. Local resident Marcus Rees is horrified.
It's literally like 10 metres away from the river, and it started going in this little stream down here. And obviously, all these horrible chemicals that we use in all of our packaging and all of our plastics, it's just going in the river and then getting straight into Oxford.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. And sorry, Brian, he does say, why didn't you mention Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales also have a chance of qualifying for the World Cup? I am taxiing in Glasgow, says Brian. Right, good luck on the roads of Glasgow this afternoon, Brian. Thank you for listening. And sorry, but we got there in the end. Now, Labour MPs are voicing their opposition to Shabana Mahmood's plans to radically overhaul the country's asylum policy, making it harder to claim asylum and easier to deport people living here illegally. The plans are modelled on Denmark's hostile immigration policy and could see jewellery taken from refugees to pay for the cost of processing them. The Home Secretary has been answering questions in the Commons.
What I have said already on these matters is that we have a proper problem that it is our moral duty to fix. Our asylum system is broken. The breaking of that asylum system is causing huge division across our whole country. It is a moral mission for me to resolve that division across our country. I know that the reforms I will be setting out later on today can fix this system, and in doing so can unite what is today a divided country.
So that's the Home Secretary speaking in the Commons a little earlier. When she does lay out exactly what's going to happen, you will hear it here on Times Radio a little later, almost certainly in the company of John Pienaar. The Labour MP Stella Creasy told Danny Finkelstein on The Times at One today why she is worried about the proposed reforms.
I'm just not confident that the answers that are being given match the evidence that we have. So I look at Home Office research itself, Danny, that says this idea that people shop around just isn't true. That's not what motivates people. If you are working on a regular basis with people in these positions, then you have a very different lived experience of what is likely to make people be able to put down roots, be able to look after their children. That's why I'm concerned that, frankly, what we'll end up seeing is ICE-style raid.
That's Stella Creasy, Labour MP. David Wood is former Director General for the Home Office's Immigration Enforcement Command. David Wood, first of all, what do you think of the Home Secretary describing this as her moral mission?
I that seems a strange explanation or comment about it. I think it's
her role as the Home Secretary to try to fix a broken asylum system. I suppose that's for her generally, for her personally, if she feels it's a moral crusade.
Well, she seems to believe that it will help ease tensions in society if this problem is dealt with, and she does see it as part of her mission.
It's difficult to see how the particular measures she's bringing forward will help tensions in society. Clearly, tensions in society are likely to be reduced if there were far more of these illegal migrants in the UK removed and hotels closed, where it obviously does cause tensions in local communities.
Just to pick up briefly on what the Labour MP Stella Creasy said, the idea that people in these positions are not looking at the various policies of individual European nations. They pick the UK for a very specific reason. What do you think of that?
I think there's some truth in that. I think they pick the UK because of the English language, the opportunities the UK offers, and that it is a system that is very compassionate to asylum seekers in this country. Obviously, they must see benefits in the UK because they just about all go through several other countries before they go across that dangerous journey across the Channel to the UK.
So let's talk about Denmark then. I don't know how much you know about the success or not of these policies in Denmark. What can you tell us about that?
I only know, in all fairness, what I've read in the media over recent days, but their immigration problem is probably far less than ours. But it would appear that the very, very harsh measures they've taken there have drastically reduced their asylum applications. I think I read today or yesterday there's only 600 and something in the last year. Well, obviously, despite the attraction to the country being far less, they are very low numbers, and clearly they have dissuaded lots of migrants to go to that country. I think language and other things are also a deterrent for migrants to go to Denmark, but it would seem that their policies would have an impact.
What about the fact that it was, I think, a Social Democrat Party in Denmark who introduced these policies, I think part of a wider coalition, but it isn't something that has offended those on the left of the Danish political spectrum. It's simply not true here, is it? There'll be many, many Labour MPs, Stella Creasy amongst them, who are very, very uneasy about all this.
Yes, it would appear so. I think there are a lot of more socialist-minded MPs would be against it. I mean, it's until recent years, it's always been highly political in the UK, but in Europe it's never been as politicised as it has been in the UK. I think that's changing a bit because of the large numbers who are migrating across the world to Europe, but it's obviously far more political in this country.
What do you make of the idea that property could be seized, including jewellery, in an effort to ease the cost of processing asylum claims to basically help the taxpayer out? Are you entirely OK with that as a notion?
Well, as a notion, I see nothing wrong with it. I think there's enormous trouble with it in practical terms. You know, how many of them would actually have assets, and certainly those across the channel, etc., wouldn't have, and how you actually go about doing that and valuing what you seize. And, you know, so I think it's pretty impractical policy to try to implement.
And we are told that property would not include anything of so-called sentimental value. So you wouldn't have, I mean, a desperate situation in which wedding rings were pulled off people's fingers or anything like that, which just sounds utterly repellent and wouldn't be something that Home Office staff would be happy to be involved with, presumably.
No, they wouldn't. I mean, obviously, if a migrant was found with a substantial amount of cash, it's probably absolutely the right thing to take that away from them to contribute towards their costs. But that, in my experience, is pretty unlikely. And so I think this is a kind of a soundbite policy rather than a policy that's very practical to implement and will make any difference.
And we still don't officially know exactly what is going to be announced. As I just want to emphasise, you will be able to hear it live when the Home Secretary speaks about this. It'll be at some point late this afternoon. You can hear it on Times Radio. But what about the notion that refugee status could be reviewed after 2.5 years? Mr Wood, do you think that's a good idea?
Well, what is being speculated in the media, and I think what the Home Secretary has said, in all fairness, is that all refugees who have been granted asylum would have to reapply every 2.5 years. Well, that will absolutely drown the Home Office. As we all know, the Home Office has struggled to deal with asylum, fresh asylum claims. Well, they would be the same staff that will be reviewing asylum claims. And obviously the numbers compound every year. So there would be enormous numbers. And it, again, wouldn't be practical or feasible. They can approach it a different way and just keep their eye on countries. And if a country changes in any way, and it's not just about safety per se, it's some countries have an issue about homosexuality and all these sort of things that is the basis for claims in this country. But they could look at where the country changes. Let's just say Syria as an example of that, or even the war in Ukraine. If that ceased and become a safe country, they then could call upon all the Ukrainians to reapply. If they did it that way, it'd be more practical. But what is being suggested at the moment is I would suggest, completely undoable, with that thousands more staff in the Home Office.
Yes, and also it would be hard to see what the incentive to integrate would be, to really work at learning English, for example, if you couldn't already speak it, if your status was always somewhat temporary and you knew that you were going to be judged again in a couple of years.
Yes, I suppose the judgment will only be about the home country, and certainly to gain any status in the UK, they have to speak English, and I think those requirements are going to increase by government policy. But yes, it doesn't help integration if they think that they've got to reapply and may not have long-term residence in the UK.
And then presumably if it is deemed, but we don't know quite what authority would deem it, that your country of origin was now safe, you might be allowed, well, I would assume you would be allowed to challenge it, to appeal against it, more paperwork, more staff needed, more time wasted.
There's that. And additionally, one of the major obstacles to deporting people is countries not cooperating. I mean, the Home Secretary has touched on this with saying she'll introduce visa sanctions. So the three African countries she's mentioned are low-volume returns to those countries. The countries with larger returns, the government will have significant problem introducing visa restrictions because of other UK government interests. But So there's a lot of, again, practical difficulties of implementing that. And the very countries that suddenly become safe, they certainly, the government is unlikely to have any form of agreement to return their refugees to them.
Do you have any, I was going to say any big ideas, but just anything that would help us sort out what appears to be an incredibly difficult problem that isn't likely? I mean, with climate change and everything else going on in the world, these issues are not going to go away.
No, I think at the moment asylum seekers can claim asylum at any stage, and it often happens, believe it or not, when they're being deported, just being put on the plane, and they claim asylum, and the whole thing has to stop and go back to square one. So there's minor changes to be done to the system, but when you look at the small boat situation, it's very, very difficult, because I don't think the measures being outlined in the Commons today will actually have a major impact on migrants wishing to cross the Channel. I think that still carry on as before. Probably the only way to stop that, which is very difficult, is to return them all immediately to France, because I guess if that happened, nobody's going to pay organised criminals thousands of pounds and then knowing that halfway across the Channel they'll be taken to France. Clearly, French aren't likely to agree that, and I'm sure that's been asked of them, and that too will cause problems in trying to implement it.
Right, so I don't want to push you again, but do you have anything that would potentially sort out this issue? I mean, everything that Shabana Mahmood is likely to propose, you've pretty much told us you don't think it's entirely workable, or it will take money, or it will mean extra staff. Is there anything she hasn't thought of that you think could be useful?
Well, I think quite major challenges to the courts, because that is what delays things considerably and removes and stops lots of removal. She's announcing, I think, some changes to Article 8 this afternoon, which will be very useful, and I think that will help in removing some migrants, because a lot of them use that particular section and abuse that section in order to remain in the UK. So that's useful. So I'm not saying everything I think that's quite welcome, the changes she's making. It's just the impact it will have and the difficulties in implementing them. No, I don't think there is any silver bullet. I think it's all making changes to the system as best you can to make it operate and try and remove the challenges. At the moment, you can appeal and appeal and appeal. So that's a major problem with the system and cost. So those sort of things being reduced and ability to remove to different countries. I mean, a third-party country is a necessary requirement. whether it be Rwanda or anywhere else, because at the moment, as I say, you cannot remove these illegal immigrants or asylum seekers who are refused asylum to their home country. There's many, many countries they can't be removed to because the countries don't properly cooperate. If you had a third country, they could immediately be removed. So that would have more impact.
So you would favour then a revival of something like the Rwanda scheme?
Yeah, a third country solution, wherever that be. The country's got to be able to take some volume. The Conservative government were going to use Rwanda, of course, for asylum claims to be considered. That would have meant that people arrived in boats, if it worked properly, and we all will not know if it would have done. But if the people arrived in the boats today and within a week were on a plane going to Rwanda, that would quickly get back and might have had some impact.
Okay.
Because their claims were going to be assessed there.
Yeah, but it never got going, of course.
No, right. And we don't know how well it would have worked, in all fairness.
We don't. But thank you very much indeed for your time. David Wood, former Director General for the Home Office's Immigration Enforcement Command.
So do you think that we should just have a suggestions box and everybody who comes on the programme should just pop a little suggestion in?
It is impossible to see a way out, isn't it? I mean, Shabana Mahmood is going to be trying something. But as that conversation has just illustrated, it's fraught with all kinds of dangers. And I hadn't, I suppose, fully appreciated that the idea of your status being reviewed every couple of years, of course it will necessitate more admin, more staff, more
massively
paperwork.
So. Yeah. And also there is going to be an immediate flaw to be seen in any plan where you declare a country to be safe. Because
it can change overnight. And who are we to say what a country is? Yeah,
exactly that.
Yeah.
This comes in from Mark, who says, I feel very uneasy about reapplying every 2 years for asylum. If we want people to integrate, we want them to get jobs and contribute to society. Without any long-term certainty, who would employ the asylum seekers? It is currently a problem for Ukrainians. Their status has been slowly extended, but when faced with an application from a Ukrainian who has 18 months versus long-term indefinite leave to remain, employers are discounting Ukrainians. And this in from an anonymous texter: in several cultures that send refugees to escape from France or the EU, gold jewellery is the store of wealth. They don't carry cash, but have thousands of pounds worth of gold jewellery to use for money later. Why can't the lefty, woke UK haters just wake up to the fact that we cannot have the whole world come here and that they can't be white saviours to make themselves feel better about their colonial guilt?
If you can, that's not aimed at us centrist nans this afternoon. We're horrified.
If you can bear to attach your name to your text, it always helps us to read them out. We like to know that you're an actual person, not a bot. Coming up, we're bots. Coming up, why has Donald Trump changed his mind about the Epstein files? That's where we're going to go to talk to the woman with all the Washington knowledge. It's Lara Spirit. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
You plan a holiday, you plan a commute. Meal plans, career plans, even workouts need a plan. So doesn't it stand to reason that your money has one too? Because the sad truth is, if it doesn't, it's just sitting there, barely growing, if at all. That's why you need a money plan. And Quilter can help. It's a lot easier to stick to than a workout plan. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
Step inside our Hotel Chocolat cafes and experience the festive magic with our limited edition drinking chocolates crafted by our chocolatiers. Sink into the crisp, creamy notes of peppermint white or the delicate spices of mince pie. Topped with cocoa whip, the crowning glory. Light as air, intensely chocolatey. Oh, go on then. It is Christmas after all. Discover your new obsession only in Hotel Chocolat cafes.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silversea brings you closer to the rare, the remote, and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Choose from thousands of products Wix have options to suit every budget. Plus, with great offers now on, it's the perfect time to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom. Find your nearest showroom at wix.co.uk.
21 minutes past three. I'm so sorry. You go for it.
How much money do you need these days in the UK in 2025 to feel properly rich? That's something we are talking about before 4 o'clock this afternoon. This is partly because there is a new and improved Times Money. It is your route to a richer life with wealth tools, expert columnists, real life stories and valuable financial insight and advice. Times Money brings together everything you need to know about money, bungs it into one place. Visit thetimes.com/money to get started.
We almost had an audio prang, didn't we?
Oh, but we avoided it because we're very careful lady drivers.
Donald Trump says the so-called Epstein files should be released in an abrupt about-face, saying that he has got nothing to hide. The US president told Republican members of Congress to vote to release the files, which he called a Democrat hoax. Dozens of Republicans have been expected to rebel in an upcoming vote, despite Trump sending personal lobbying messages against it. Lara Spirit is Washington correspondent for The Times. Hello, Lara.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm very well, but just reading out that cue is a bit dizzying, isn't it? So can you tell us where we find ourselves today with the Epstein files and give us your thoughts on why?
Yes, so tomorrow the House will vote on that measure to release the Epstein files in full. We knew even before President Trump's quite staggering reversal last night in a post on Truth Social that that vote was looking all but guaranteed to pass, that a critical number of Republican members of the House were prepared to defy Trump's previous claims that it was a Democratic hoax, previous and clear lobbying efforts summoning one to a meeting in the White House Situation Room, for example, one wavering member of Congress to try and persuade them not to go forward and back this proposal to release the files. Also having a very extraordinary public breakdown in relations with Marjorie Taylor Greene, the once loyal Republican Congresswoman from Georgia, in part over her demand to release these files in full. And she has claimed that that is behind her big fallout. So for that reason, it was surprising perhaps to see Trump yesterday say that actually these files should be released. He says we have nothing to hide. In many ways, this is him getting ahead of an eventuality that was basically inevitable at this point. As I say, they were very, very likely to pass this measure in the House. Does it actually change anything with regard to whether we're going to see the full Epstein files or not? Well, that is the interesting question, because in the Senate, it still faces very tough odds. Democrats hold 47 seats. They'll need 60 votes on this to pass that through the Senate. We don't know from John Thune, the majority leader in the Senate, whether or not they're even going to have a vote on this, nor do we know, crucially, whether Trump is prepared to sign it into law. So many unknowns still around about this at the moment. It's just very interesting to see, as you say, Trump change his position.
Yeah. And Lara, clear something up for me, and I'm sorry if this is a very, very basic question, but the Epstein files, when we talk about them, those are different to the Epstein emails, the cache of which seems to be quite giving in terms of information and incrimination. Or are the emails all in the files too?
Yeah, so the emails, as you say, we've seen more than 20,000 of those released last week by lawmakers on the House Oversight Committee. Those were subpoenaed from the Epstein estate by that group of lawmakers who are trying to get to the bottom of this. Of course, the Epstein files is much more expansive. It encompasses a massive range of documents that, of course, we haven't yet seen, so we don't know the contents of them yet. But it's safe to say that those 20,000 emails, of course, are not the full files as we know them, even though, of course, they were a very, very extensive series of documentation that journalists are still to this day pouring through.
And is it possible, Lara, that Donald Trump and his team have seen much more of what's in the Epstein files and emails and anything else to come than anybody else has? And therefore, they do believe that Donald Trump is very much in the clear and not about to be incriminated?
Well, that's the big question. Trump has we should say, not been accused of any wrongdoing. He's not been accused of taking part in the sex trafficking operations of Epstein. And indeed, last week on Friday, he ordered the Justice Department to look into some of Epstein's links with prominent donors and Democrats. Clearly, he believes this is a Democrat hoax, as he says, but also that people are kind of overemphasizing the question of his relationship. And he's obviously said that he had no knowledge whatsoever of the solicitation of underage prostitution before that plea by Epstein in 2008. And so for that reason, he obviously thinks that there's been a big over-exaggeration of his particular case in this, and that there should be a greater focus elsewhere. And that's something, of course, that the Epstein files will seek to answer.
So you've told us a bit about all of the shenanigans that it's caused within the Republican Party. But what about out on Main Street? Now, with all of this whirlwind and merry-go-round of different cries from Donald Trump and his team about what they believe lies behind all of this, what's the effect on voters?
Well, it's a very good question. And actually, it's interesting that you ask that, because at this particular time, Trump is preparing to go on the offensive on the question of affordability. So we will see him talk about that at a McDonald's event tonight, for example. Clearly, the Republicans are worried after, almost a fortnight ago, they had a very difficult set of off-year election results, not just, of course, Sohrab Mamdani's victory in New York, but much more consequentially in Virginia and New Jersey as well. Well, as some other down ballot races elsewhere. So they are clearly concerned about this question about affordability, whether prices are going up or not. And Trump has been last night, while he was posting about the Epstein files, saying actually he wants Republicans to get back on message. He wants them to refocus on this question of affordability, talking to voters about what Republicans, in their view, are doing to try to bring down the cost of living, something that Trump was very, very focused about campaigning on during the election itself, and which now they're trying to kind of get on the front foot on again. And you'll see perhaps some measures in the coming days that they'll want to talk about more. The message from Trump there to many of his Republican lawmakers is the more you talk about Epstein, the less you talk about these other priorities that we are trying to work on, and the more likely you are to damage your own electoral prospects in the process.
And Lara, in this country, when there has been a discussion about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's involvement with Jeffrey Epstein, there are so many normal people who just want him now to tell tales about what happened, about what he saw, about who else was there, to be a helpful part of an investigation, something that he once promised to do, but we have seen no sign of him actually doing it. Is there the same sense from the American electorate that actually what they want from their president is to be more helpful to the victims of Epstein's crimes by simply telling everybody what he knows? Because he was definitely in the circle at some point.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because when you talk to Democrats, they will say, actually, we're not over focusing on Epstein. We think this is something that has broad cut through with many people in the electorate. There's obviously some irony in the fact that it was Democrats who used to be quieter on this than many in the MAGA Republican base, who have been kind of foremost advocates for full transparency on the case of Epstein. So when it comes to kind of partisanship on this, I think that's quite interesting. But I think, as I say, clearly the White House now wanting to get on the front foot on other questions of affordability at this point, and convinced that actually voters care much more about the money in their pockets than they do about this, important though it is.
What's the McDonald's event tonight?
Yeah,
and are
what
you
is
going?
Yeah.
Are you going to have a happy meal, Lara?
There is a McDonald's Impact Summit, and it is not actually just President Trump who will be there. There are also going to be appearances from some, including leading Democrats like Wes Moore, governor in Maryland, of course, and kind of a great stage for talking about these questions of affordability. For Trump, of course, it's redolent of that very popular appearance and now fabled appearance in the McDonald's drive-through that you'll remember during the election.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember this?
I do.
Which I would be very unsurprised if that's what we're mentioning of tonight. So worth keeping an eye on. I think it'll be in the early hours of the morning for you.
Up for it.
We'll be watching.
I'm going to make sure he gets my drink right. I think you're a medium fries kind of gal, woman after my own heart. Thank you very much. Lara Spirit is Washington correspondent for The Times.
Quarter pounder with cheese and a chocolate shake. That's what I'd go for. What I do go for. Let's just be honest. Thank you, Lara. Next on Times Radio, Robbie Millen, the literary editor of the Times and the Sunday Times. He'll be hosting our regular Monday afternoon literary salon with some good recommendations for you. And we'll also discuss with Holly Mead before 4 o'clock, how much money do you need these days to feel properly rich? Let's get the headlines just after 3:30. Here's James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The Home Secretary is preparing to lay out radical reforms to the asylum system in the House of Commons later. One of the new proposals Shabana Mahmood's considering involves asylum seekers funding accommodation costs with their own valuables. The Border Security Minister, Alex Norris, was asked what that means and whether it would mean people arriving in the UK would be stripped of their jewellery at the border.
No, of course not. What we're saying, though, if someone comes over with a bag full of gold rings, well, that's different to a family heirloom or, you know, or personal items.
The chairman of the BBC says the corporation is determined to fight Donald Trump's threat of a potential multi-billion dollar lawsuit. Samir Shah says there's no basis for a defamation case over the editing of a speech by the US president. All files relating to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein could be released soon after Mr. Trump changed his stance on their publication. Last night, the president urged Republicans to support the disclosure, saying we have nothing to hide. The ousted Prime Minister of Bangladesh has been sentenced to death for ordering crackdowns on protests. Sheikh Hasina, who's believed to be hiding in India, has called the verdict biased and politically motivated. And amber cold health alerts are in force for large parts of the UK until Saturday. The Health Security Agency warns of sub-zero temperatures in the northeast, northwest and Yorkshire and the Humber. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
It's easy to forget just how crazy things have been over the past couple of years. Every day we wake up to something new, tariffs and taxes on anything and everything. It's tempting to put your hands in your ears and go, la 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 la, I can't hear you, until it's all over. But you know what's the best response to crazy times? A plan for your money. And Quilter can help. Because let's face it, there's probably going to be some crazy times ahead too. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
Mr. Thing loves winter. Fluffy slippers, hot chalk, the heating on. Uh-oh, that didn't sound good. Looks like the boiler's packed in. Thankfully, Mr. Thing has British Gas Home Care cover, which means unlimited repairs for his boiler, heating, electrics and more. And right now, it's 50% off for the first 6 months. Search British Gas Home Care, one of the ways we're taking care of things. T's and C's apply. No claims within the first 14 days. Ends 1st of December. New customers only. Remaining 6 months at full price.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast. 7 days a week from 6 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. There's over 70 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the spend and save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
Good afternoon. Welcome to our book section here on the Times. Yes, here on the Times Radio afternoon programme with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. Robbie Millen is the... Are you still literary editor?
Yes, so far. I know we're all bored with it now, aren't we?
Of the Times and the Sunday Times.
Get rid of him.
Well, a very welcome visitor to our to our place every Monday afternoon.
Your boudoir.
It's not strictly speaking a boudoir, but I see you on the chaise longue. I do, really. Right. Now, we try to be a little upmarket in this segment. This week is no exception. So where do you want to start, actually? Where can you take us?
Can I start with a thriller?
Yes, please.
I am going on the Queen Mary 2. you know, it was a floating gin palace, the ocean liner, for part of the Times Cheltenham Literature Festival at Sea.
Yeah.
And one of the people I'm interviewing on board it is a man called Peter Hannington, who's a thriller writer. So I've been reading, I mean, I've got to interview him, and it'd be terrible if I didn't like it. But it's terrific. He wrote a thriller called A Dying Breed, which is the first in, I think, a series of three about a washed-up, drunken BBC journalist, a veteran, unpredictable hack. And for some reason, he spoke to me. Who gets embroiled in this kind of hall of, so, you know, smoke and mirrors and things like that. And a bomb goes off in Kabul, where he's sort of been reporting from. Who could be behind it? And it becomes very mysterious. But it's a brilliant insight into the world of radio, in particular the Today programme, where Pete Hannington worked for many years.
Well, I must confess, I haven't read this, but I think I'm going to. And Fee, just acknowledge your connection to the author of this
well,
tome.
OK, so Peter and I worked together at GLR way back in the day, so we have known each other.
That's a local station in London.
Oh. Yep, for 34 years, and we have remained friends. So we work together at Radio 4.
Do you fall out with people?
As well.
I mean,
no,
friends.
I try very hard never to. So I know him and his work well. And I think actually he did a really bold thing with Dying Breed, which I think is a brilliant book about journalism and
what
the shifting tectonic plates underneath it.
Yeah.
So the people who want to imagine themselves to be these absolute paragons of virtue, but actually sometimes they're not there.
Become rather compromised
yes,
in all sorts
they're compromised
of
and
exciting
they're human
ways.
And all of that. But he wrote that book very soon after leaving the Today programme. But you can really recognise the, and I can never say this word, you will know what I mean by imprimatur. Is that right?
No, I don't know what you mean.
No.
So you can see the template of reality that he's taken the fiction from very clearly with certain characters.
Yeah,
I mean, really clearly.
Oh, okay.
With certain characters. So I think
a libel
it was bold.
Lawyer read this.
Yes,
they,
closely, closely. But he's got away with it brilliantly.
Yeah.
But it makes it a very compelling read because think, no, I really know. I know who I'm thinking of. When I read this book, I'll leave it at that.
Well, it has the real smack of authority as well. Just the thing, how the Today programme is put together.
Yeah.
That poor people having to do the night shift.
Yes, I don't think anybody listens to it anymore because there are so many wonderful alternatives, not least our own Stig and Kate, 6 till 10, Monday to Thursday.
Yeah. Gotcha. It's like a piece of period drama.
Yes, it is. Yes, very much.
Yes, exactly. Like one of those dusty Victorian things.
Yeah. that's not his new book, is it?
Or? No. This was the first one,
right.
And he's written at least two others. There's one called A Single Source, A Cursed Place, and I believe there's another one coming out in the new year.
So he's got a new novel coming out in the new year, but it's not part of this series. It is about a TV journalist with dementia, and in between the gaps fall the, you know, he reveals his sources, starts to reveal strange things that he knew that he should be keeping quiet about once upon a time. It's going to be very clever.
Mm.
Oh, that's interesting. So that is Peter Hannington, and the book is A Dying Breed. And the good news, if you enjoy that, and I'm sure you will from the sound of things, there's a whole series of thrillers. So that is really interesting, and he's going to be one of your guests on that. I mean, what happens on the cruise? I mean, Fee and I we're not really cruisers, but I don't know, we might give it a whirl.
Do you know what? I love cruising, but technically,
what Pop Mitch says.
Hurry on. But technically, it's a crossing because it's crossing the Atlantic. So this is more than just a cruise. It's not a booze cruise, although people do drink a lot.
Yes.
And they've got this great canteen on board, which is like going to a John Lewis canteen.
Right. Oh,
and
brilliant.
And by the end, within 1 week, you can usually put on about a stone of weight.
Mm, really? So the food just keeps on coming?
It keeps on coming. Yeah. I mean, that's why I go.
When you say it's like the John Lewis Cafe, are people coming to serve you, or you're taking your tray along and helping yourself?
It's a bit tray during lunch, but it's formal dining in the evening.
Okay.
Bib and tuck and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm not naturally a cruiser.
Move on.
I have been known.
Self-improvement is the topic of our next book that we're focusing on. And this is Music's Odyssey, An Invitation to Western Classical Music by Robin Holloway. Sounds very intriguing. Tell me about it, please.
Well, first of all, it's very big. It's 1,200 pages.
Oh, well,
it's
keep me quiet.
But it's one of those, you know, those occasional moments when you think, come on, Robbie. Well, you probably don't say that. Only I say that because you've all got your own names.
But
you think self-improvement. And this is Robin Holloway, I think he's been an academic specialising in classical music for nearly 50 years. And it's kind of everything he knows, but in a very opinionated way. So rather than just kind of being a drab piece of musicology, he's very spicy with his views. He describes himself, musically, I'm a Hun. He likes all the Germans, Bach and Schubert.
So is this a book for somebody who wants to know more about classical music or already knows a lot about
it? I think it's one of those, I would say you would probably have to... have a bit of knowledge, but it's one of those, I think, just give you more confidence in having opinions. And he had loads of opinions. I've written some down for you. So he would say, Puccini's Mad and Butterfly, which I love, but Butterfly is more manipulative still than Tosca, the erotic sadomasochism, and yet further to the fore, an unbearable affair. It hits below the belt. It's unfair. It exploits. So not a fan of Puccini's Mad and Butterfly. But then he loves Vivaldi's Four Seasons. He surpasses Bach. This is Vivaldi. He surpasses Bach in his feeling for instrumental colour. Witness the Four Seasons with their enchanting evocations of birds, bees, insects, the times of day as well of the year. So it's kind of, I think it's one of those things, if you read it, read it with kind of YouTube or Spotify open.
Okay.
And then it comes to life, I
but
think.
But it sounds like a thumping great
thumping
gift.
It would make a very good gift to an uncle that maybe you like a bit, but not that much.
No, and also a useful doorstop from the sound of things. Right, you've also been reading the mid-century social comedy Sisters by a River. Now, this is by Barbara Commons,
I think that's right.
Now, she was one of those women who success slightly passed her by.
Exactly. She's one of those, I love mid-century women. There's a whole kind of gang of them. People like Muriel Spark and Barbara Pym are better known. Barbara Commons is one of the less well-known.
Yeah.
She had a great way with book titles, by the way. She had a novel called Our Spoons Came from Woolworths. Is that not a brilliant title for a novel?
It's a brilliant title. It's more success than it had, I think.
Yeah, no, exactly. But this is particularly wonderful because it's because I like stories about sort of rackety posh families with feral children.
Why do you like those, Robin?
I don't know. You know, you think of Dodie Smith's I Capture the Castle. This is like this, but this is kind of more feral because it's all told from the point of view of the children. So it's written with all the spelling mistakes of children. Oh. And it's just, you know, when children are left to their own devices, they're savages.
Yes.
So I like that.
Well, Lord of the Flies is coming to the BBC quite soon, isn't it?
Imagine it, Lord of the Flies with jokes.
Right, that's what it is. Okay, right.
Put that on the back.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm definitely going to read Peter Hannington's book. I'm not sure about the others, if I'm honest. Are you reading anything interesting at the moment, Fee?
No.
I'm reading. I'm glad you asked.
I love the way the conversation just flows.
Well, it kind of does. I mean, you could loosely say that's the secret of our moderate success, Robbie.
Do you know what? I've read so many huge books for work at the moment. I'm genuinely not reading anything at all this week.
Well, I am reading, I'm sure I won't get this right. It's called The Listeners, and it's by Maggie Stiefvater. Have you heard of that?
No.
She's a New York Times bestseller. It's a book I thought I'd enjoy more than I am, if I'm honest, but it's about...
What a terrific recommendation.
It's about an isolated hotel in rural America. It's 1942.
Okay.
And there's something strange about the local waters.
Ooh.
And the hotel has to clear its guests overnight. Ooh. And they are replaced by Axis prisoners, if you like. So German nationals and Italian nationals.
Ooh.
And people who were in America. Ooh. And they need to keep an eye on them. It's, for some reason, it's not quite got going for me, but it has been highly critically acclaimed.
Oh. Yeah. Do you know what, though? Just dump it if you don't like it. There's always the rule.
Cost me 15 quid.
Well, Oxfam. Give it to Oxfam.
Yes, OK.
Recycle.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think life is too short to plough on through books. I used to make myself, but I don't do that anymore.
It's not
a little midlife
test.
Treat. No, it's not. And also, it takes away a part of your brain that you could be using on something that you really love. Why would you do that?
Mary says, I was just looking at the prices for that crossing on November the 19th.
Is it expensive?
Well, it's $499 for an inside cabin. It's not bad, says Mary, but I wouldn't be happy with an inside cabin.
Oh.
How long does it take to cross?
Oh, it's about six nights.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have to go a funny way up the coast of Newfoundland or somewhere like that to make it a week. You can look out of your... I mean, it's not really worth having a cabin.
Because
all you can see is brown sea and grey sky. And sometimes the sky is brown and the sea is grey.
No wonder the buffet's busy.
Right, okay.
I'm feeling a little bit ill just talking about this, but good luck with your crossing.
Yes, no, it is great fun. Honestly, you're trapped with a couple of thousand other people.
Robbie, you haven't sold it to us.
We're not going. We Jane and I have both been asked if we'd like to do this, the Times thing, and we've both politely declined.
I'll give up my space.
No, because we very much like going to Cheltenham, that's as far as they can get us. So that's fair enough at our age.
Yes, well, yes.
Yeah, Robbie, it's lovely to see you. You didn't have to agree with that.
No, sorry.
It's Jane and Fee at times.radio. We're 0333 003 2353. I tell you what, if anyone can be bothered between now and 4 o'clock, I would love a recommendation of just a really fabulous novel. I've done a lot of crime fiction recently, done a lot of autobiography and quite a lot of fact, and I would like to lose myself in a really good book about family, about love.
Go on, he's got his hand up, yeah.
I probably mentioned it loads of times last year. Wellness by Nathan Hill is terrific.
Okay, I have started that before and not finished it. Should
what?
I go back to it?
You should do. I'm thinking less of you now.
Oh, well, I didn't think that was possible, Robin. I'll dig it out. It's quite big, isn't it?
Yeah, but you'll be lost in it. And it's got very funny chapters. So keep you know.
Okay, I'm going to return to it then. Exactly. I'll give it another go. Yeah. Thank you. So no need to text in, everybody. At ease. This is Jane and Fee.
I'm sure everyone's at ease after that.
This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia. And we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Thank you for your suggestions. You can, of course, keep them coming in. This one comes from Julie. All the Colours of the Dark by Chris Whittaker.
Didn't like that.
You didn't like that?
No, I gave up on that.
Oh, OK. This is actually from Trudy, who thinks it's a fabulous book. What didn't you like about it?
It was just depressing. It was about, I think it was about a kidnapped child and, I couldn't.
OK.
In the end, it was too much.
And Avril says, Jane... The names, Florence Knapp, it's wonderful. I've read that and I loved it too.
Yeah, I know, that's a very good book.
Really, really loved it. Just the conceit of it, I thought was just extraordinary. So thank you for both of those. And if anybody else has got another recommendation, 0333 002353. It's got to be about love, maybe about family, in a modern setting, and no huge, horrible crime involved. What does it take to feel rich? A six-figure salary, seven-figure cash savings, a mortgage-free home? Apparently not. Just 3% of people in Britain consider themselves rich, while 45% of us feel financially vulnerable. This is according to the inaugural Times Wealth Survey. Holly Mead is money expert and host of the Times' Feel Better About Money podcast and joins us now. Hello, Holly.
Good afternoon.
Just flesh this out a little bit more for us. When we're talking about rich, what are we actually talking about here? Put some numbers on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a hard one, isn't it? It's one of those classic, how long is a piece of string questions. So I remember when I first started out in the working world and was earning an absolute pittance, if you'd said to me, well, if you say to most people you could earn 125 grand, they'd say, that is rich, isn't it? But this survey, and we polled more than 4,000 people, found that the idea of wealth is just such a relative term. And I think what gets overlooked is the fact that actually as people's earnings go up, it tends to be that their outgoings go up too. And actually it can be that the people that are richest on paper, i.e. have the biggest incomes, actually have the biggest outgoings. And it's all their family finances are quite often on a bit of a precipice because they might have really extended themselves on the mortgage. The children might be in private school. And I don't know, maybe there's a bigger car or two or three cars on the driveway, all on finance agreements. And it only takes one thing to go wrong for suddenly the numbers to not stack up anymore. So what we found was even people who are earning around that level can feel vulnerable because they feel like they're quite often on a treadmill where they need to keep working so hard to make it work.
But do you think, Holly, it's also telling us something about the super rich people who we see parading themselves or being paraded in front of us? So even if you are earning £120,000, which is a life-changing sum of money for most people in this country, the fact that you are always seeing people who are so much better off than you makes you think, well, actually, I'm not rich. I'm not top of the pile.
I think the age of social media makes it so hard to know what's real and what isn't as well, because you can see celebrities or influencers seemingly living an absolutely luxurious life, but it doesn't actually mean they've got cash in the bank. It might just mean that they're being sent clothes for free. And hey, if anyone wants to send me clothes for free, they're very welcome to, but it doesn't pay my mortgage. So I think there is this kind of warped perception, and in an age where we can see so much of people's lives and perhaps things aren't being presented in a totally true or transparent way, it can be really hard to kind of that keeping up with the Joneses feeling is kind of squared these days, isn't it?
Yeah. And also there's an insecurity around at the moment, isn't there, which everybody is feeling. So perhaps you could no longer think, well, I'm earning this enormous amount of money and I will be earning this enormous amount of money for a good couple of years. So I will be rich. I will see the benefits of it further down the line. I think inherent in all of us at the moment is this feeling that the whole rug might be pulled from under everybody at any given moment.
I also think we've got this sort of anti-aspirational problem among higher earners at the moment, or people that are aspiring to become higher earners in the UK, where the tax system is so punitive on people that earn around certain thresholds that almost becoming rich makes you poorer. So we know that people that earn families that once their earnings go to £60,000, they start to lose their child benefit. So they take a pay rise, which should be something that everyone should be aspiring to and feel great about, and then they work out that actually it's left them worse off because they now have a bigger tax bill and they've missed out on thousands of pounds of help with their family each year. And we see the same thing at that £100,000 earning mark, and this is the real cliff edge, because you lose, if you're a family, you lose access to tax-free childcare, you lose the free childcare hours, and you start to lose your personal allowance, which is the amount you can earn before you pay any income tax. So actually, once you earn £100,000, you pay a marginal tax rate, so that's the tax you pay on the next pound you earn, of about 62%. So actually, it is bizarre that people earning around £100,000 at the moment, which is something that many people could only dream of, are actually feeling the squeeze more than any other demographic.
Yeah. Were you surprised by the findings of this? It is the inaugural Times Wealth Survey.
I was a bit depressed by it. Am I allowed to say that? It's just a bit of a shame. I think we've seen this. We've been writing about this delightful concept of fiscal drag in the paper for a good few years. And it is that fiscal drag is that thing of people being dragged into paying more tax just because they're getting a pay rise, because our income tax thresholds are not rising with the cost of living. So every pound extra we earn, we're actually becoming worse off by it. It's a really sort of it's, as I say, sort of an anti-aspirational phenomenon. We live in hope that perhaps come next Wednesday at the budget we'll see some good news around it. But
oh, we certainly do, Holly. We absolutely do. Let's move on to something else. A contributing factor, though, it could be inflation. And you've written a piece in The Times reviewing how much inflation is costing individuals. This is fascinating. Talk us through what you found.
Yeah, it's just so interesting because I think we hear a lot at the moment about inflation coming down, and you know, you don't need a long memory to recall when it was up in 10-11%, and that was a really difficult winter in particular when we saw all of our energy bills spike. So people talk about the inflation rate falling, and that's obviously not a bad thing, but it doesn't mean that prices go down. It just means that they rise at a slower rate. But that overall figure doesn't actually tell us much. So inflation came in at 3.8% last month. But whether you have a mortgage, whether you drink or smoke or eat meat or have kids in private education, or whether you rent or whether you even have a dog, affects your own personal inflation rate. And again, we sort of found that it was families with young children that are really feeling the pinch here, and also those people who are kind of just starting off in their life of adulthood. So if you're fresh out of university and moved away from home and renting for the first time, it's, you know, really exciting to be getting a regular wage for the first time in your life, but because rents have gone up so much and you're kind of feeling the burden there, that it's also that demographic that are feeling the squeeze.
Yeah. And is it also as simple as in those two cohorts you're talking about, actually you are having to buy a lot of stuff? I mean, if you are living as a pensioner, it stands to reason, of course you've got your energy bills and all of that kind of stuff, but you're not needing to go shopping for a new set of clothes every 6 months because you've still got growing people in the house.
Yeah, I think the hard bit for young families is there's less flex in the budget. For if you've got dependents, young children, you know, you can't just suddenly start cutting back on the grocery bill. Like if you, I don't know, were a single person living on your own, you might try and make some quite harsh cutbacks because it's only you being affected. So I think families have a lot less flexibility there. For pensioners, I think the difficulty, although we found that they had on average the lowest inflation rate, because as you say, I mean, a big part of that is that most of them tend to be mortgage free. But they're on a fixed income usually, and that can be difficult. So if you are just in receipt of the state pension and maybe your own small private pension pot of savings, then you can't just suddenly go out and try and get a new job or a job with a higher income to try and deal with the rising cost of living. You are very much stuck with the savings you have to deal with that. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges facing pensioners with regards to inflation.
Holly, thank you very much indeed. Two great pieces about your money in The Times today. One is that piece about inflation and how much it is costing you, and the other is the first ever Times Wealth Survey, which produced this astonishing fact that 94% of high earners, people earning between 100 grand and 125 grand, don't consider themselves to be rich.
But Holly did outline why they don't, didn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for the great book recommendations. Andy says, how about Still Life by Sarah Winman? It's life-affirming and beautiful. Winman, yes, I've got that right. You Are Here by David Nichols, says Jackie. I think a lot of people have enjoyed that. I haven't actually read that either. Julie says, how about Blue Sisters by Coco Mellors? Excellent. No Violence, it's the story of the lives of four sisters. And Geraldine, hard recommend, she says, for The Best of Everything by Kit Duvall. It really touched me. Thanks all. We're back tomorrow. And who do we want to thank on the programme? Only Ryan Boyden, our technical operator. And she was in and out a bit today, but essentially in charge, Rosie Cutler. She was in and out, wasn't she? It wasn't just my imagination. She's here now. But
she's in now. Yeah.
There we are. John Pienaar is next. Have a good evening.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Fee. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar. This is Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. The Prime Minister says the government is reforming the asylum system to cope with a volatile and insecure world. And the chairman of the BBC says the corporation is determined to fight the planned lawsuit from Donald Trump. And coming up, we'll be looking closely at the government's plans for a former head of the Home Office and a former boss of Border Force. And a senior Ukrainian politician says there may soon be as many deserters as soldiers in the Ukrainian military.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer has warned the asylum system is under severe strain as the Home Secretary prepares to announce a series of major reforms. The changes include lengthening the period a refugee has to wait before being able to claim permanent settlement from 5 to 20 years. Some Labour backbenchers have branded the proposal shameful. Responding to criticism in the Commons this afternoon, Shabana Mahmood said she was on a moral mission to heal divisions.
We have a proper problem that it is our moral duty to fix. Our asylum system is broken. The breaking of that asylum system is causing huge division across our whole country. It is a moral mission for me to resolve that division across our country. I know that the reforms I will be setting out later on today can fix this system, and in doing so can unite what is today a divided country.
The chairman of the BBC says it's determined to fight the planned lawsuit from Donald Trump, insisting there's no basis for a defamation case. The US president's threatening to sue for up to $5 billion over the Panorama edit of his speech ahead of the Capitol riots in January 2021. The corporation's apologized for what it's called an error of judgment. Meanwhile, all files relating to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein could be released soon after Mr. Trump changed his stance on their publication. Last night, the president urged Republicans to support the disclosure, saying we have nothing to hide. Details of Epstein's relationship with Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor led to the former prince being stripped of his royal titles. The former US Vice President Mike Pence says there's no better antiseptic than daylight.
I know the president has very strenuously denounced this matter as a hoax. You'd have to talk to people a lot closer to him to know and understand that. I simply know of no reason from our time together in the White House why all these files should not be released.
Poland's prime minister says an explosion on a rail line used to transport aid to Ukraine was an act of sabotage. Damage was reported yesterday morning on part of the track linking the capital, Warsaw, with its eastern neighbor. It's not yet clear who was responsible, but Polish authorities have detained dozens of people over suspected sabotage since Russia's war began in February 2022. Bin strikes in Birmingham could continue into next year, with agency workers voting to join council employees on the picket line. Unite members have been staging all-out action since March over proposed pay cuts and job losses. Onay Kassab from the union says talks need to resume quickly.
Instead of this strike going backwards, if you like, where people are going back into work, what's happening is more people are joining the strike action. And also the fact that with the ballot closed today, that gives us a further 6 months mandate. That takes into the local elections. So the council need to take note.
Birmingham City Council says the service needs to be transformed. And cold weather alerts have been stepped up across Britain as Arctic air sweeps southwards. Northern England's under an amber alert until Saturday, meaning possible threat to life, while the rest of the country has a less severe yellow warning. There are also Met Office alerts for snow and ice for parts of England and Scotland later this week. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with IG.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. They sometimes say that someone who's making a conspicuous performance of taking on a problem is making a drama out of a crisis. Well, today the Home Secretary has obviously decided that she has no other choice than to make a drama out of the problem of asylum seekers and unlawful migration into Britain. The policy is undeniably tough, the presentation surely deliberately performative. Shabana Mahmood, her plans are dramatic. Does the government really see this then as a crisis? Well,
What do you think when you see the Home Secretary telling the country that illegal migration is tearing our country apart, dividing communities? The second part of that claim says a lot. No, talk of the dividing of communities points to a political position that is about public anger and an argument that Labour government losing and its opponents, well, they're under a great deal of pressure. Nigel Farage and Reform are winning this argument. So a minister who is a daughter of Pakistani migrants, one who openly expresses her fear that anger about illegal migration could breed racism, a Home Secretary who's happy to be described as one of the toughest that we've seen, is setting out plans that the government hopes will slow the flow of cross-channel migrants and help Labour redeem its popularity and fight back against its critics. The plans being spelled out to the MPs today are going to be reported by us, discussed by us on the programme today. What are they? Well, the decades-long principle of permanent refuge for those granted asylum seekers will come to an end. Instead, asylum seekers will have to wait 20 years to apply for settled status. Asylum seekers will be returned home if their country is deemed safe. There'll be new powers for the Home Secretary to take valuables like jewelries, cars, e-bikes from illegal migrants to pay for the costs of processing asylum claims and accommodation. I wonder what you make of it all so far. Tell me your thoughts. Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Now, Home Secretary then, going to be making a statement a little bit later on this afternoon. We'll hopefully have that for you live on air on the programme. Earlier on Times Radio Breakfast, Alex Norris, the Minister for the Home Office and for Border Security, he outlined the government's thinking.
Illegal migration is being done in an uncontrolled way, is a way that's not fair, in ways that's putting burdens on communities across the country, and that has to change. And part of that is breaking those reasons that people think that Britain is a golden ticket to come to. Part of it is to make sure, and these visa sanctions are a significant element of this, to make sure that those who have no legitimate reason to be here are removed. And then part of it will be about establishing safe and legal routes so that there is a good way to come that doesn't involve people crossing the continent, doesn't involve people making dangerous journeys across the channel. So our message to people who might be seeking asylum is that Britain is a generous, open and tolerant country, but we are getting a grip of our system.
The Home Office Minister, Alex Norris. But also on Times Radio Breakfast, the Reform UK Deputy Leader, Richard Tice, he shared his thinking.
Well, I think the comments from the Home Secretary are, in a sense, welcome talk, it's welcome language, but for all the best will in the world, she's not going to be able to deliver it because of membership of the European Convention on Human Rights and the Human Rights Act. And already we're seeing parts of her own party rebelling against it. And I mean, the sort of language she's using here in November, they were describing when we were using similar language 2 months ago, the Labour Party was describing us as racist bigots.
That's Richard Tice. Now, the Home Secretary has been taking questions. She was urged by the SNP's Pete Wishart to create a more humane asylum programme and not pander to Nigel Farage. This is what she said.
What I'm interested in is recognising the extent of the problems that this government has inherited and coming up with proper solutions to those problems.